Then. Arky had an old Ford pickup in those days, a standard three-shifter. "But I got four if you count the reverse," he used to joke, with a squeaky clutch. He parked it where he would still be parking 23 years later, although by then he would have traded up to a Dodge Ram with the automatic transmission and the four-wheel drive. In 1979, there was an ancient Statler County school bus at the far end of the parking lot, a rust-rotted yellow barge that had been there since the Korean War, at least, sinking deeper and deeper into the weeds and the dirt with each passing year. Why no one ever took it away was just another of life's mysteries. Arky nestled his truck in beside it, then crossed to Shed B, and looked through one of the windows in the roll-up door, cupping his hands to block the light of the sun, which was on the wester. There was a light on overhead, and the Buick sat beneath it, looking to Arky like a display model, the kind of unit that shows up so pretty under the lights that anyone in his right mind would want to sign on the line and drive that honey home. Everything looked fly-by, except for the trunk lid. It was up again. "I ought to report that to the duty officer," Arky thought. He wasn't a cop, just a custodian. But in his case, Trooper Gray rubbed off. He stepped back from the window, then happened to glance up at the thermometer Kurt had mounted from one of the overhead beams. The temperature in the shed had gone up again, and by quite a lot. 61 degrees in there. It occurred to Arky that the Buick was like some sort of weird refrigerator coil that had now turned itself off, or perhaps burned itself out during the fireworks show. The sudden rise in temperature was something else no one knew, and Arky was excited. He started to swing away from the door, meaning to hurry directly across to the barracks. That was when he saw the thing in the corner of the shed. "Nothing but an old bunch of rags," he thought. But something else suggested, well, something else. He went back to the glass, once more cupping his hands to the sides of his face, and no, by God, that thing in the corner was not just a bunch of rags. Arky felt a flu-like weakness in the joints of his knees and the muscles of his thighs. The feeling spread upward into his stomach, dropping it, and then to his heart, speeding it up. There was an alarming moment when he was almost certain he was going to drop to the ground in a faint. "Hey, you big dumb Swede, why don't you try breathing again, see if that helps any?" Arky took 2 big dry gasps of air, not caring much for the sound of them. His old man had sounded like that when he was having his heart attack, lying on the sofa and waiting for the ambulance to come. He stepped away from the roll-up door, patting the center of his chest with the side of a closed fist. "Come on, honey. Take up the slack now." The sun, going down in a cauldron of blood, glared in his eyes. His stomach had continued to drop, making him feel on the verge of vomiting. The barracks all at once looked 2, maybe even 3 miles away. He set off in that direction, reminding himself to breathe and concentrating on taking big, even steps. Part of him wanted to break into a run, and part of him understood that if he tried doing that, he really might faint. Guys, it'd never let you hear the end of that, and you know it. But it wasn't really teasing he was concerned about. Mostly, he didn't want to go in looking all wild-eyed and pushing the panic button like any John Q in off the road with a tale to tell. And by the time he got inside, Arky actually did feel a little better. Still scared, but no longer like he was going to puke or just go bolting away from Shed B any old which way. By then, he'd also had an idea which had eased his mind a bit. Maybe it was just a trick, a prank. Troopers were always pulling stuff on him, and hadn't he told Orville Garrett he might come back that evening for a little looky-see at that old Buick? He had. And maybe Orv had decided to give him the business. bunch of comedians he worked with. Someone was always giving him the business. The thought served to calm him, but in his heart of hearts, Archie didn't believe it. Orv Garrett was a practical joker, all right, liked to have his fun just like the next guy, but he wouldn't make that thing in the shed part of a gag. None of them would. Not with Sergeant Shaindink so hopped up about it. Ah, but the Sarge wasn't there. His door was shut, and the frosted glass panel was dark. The light was on in the kitchenette, though, and music was coming out through the door. Joan Baez, singing about the night they drove old Dixie down. Archie went in, and there was Huddy Royer, just dropping a monster chunk of oleo into a pot of noodles. Your heart ain't gonna thank you for that shit, Archie thought. Huddy's radio, a little one on a strap that he took every place, was sitting on the counter next to the toaster. Hey, Archie, he said. What are you doing here? As if I didn't know. Is Orv around? Archie asked. Nope, he's got 3 days off, starting tomorrow. Lucky sucker went fishing. You want a bowl of this? Huddy held the pot out, took a really good look at him, and realized he was looking at a man who was scared just about to death. Archie, what the hell's wrong with you? Archie sat down heavily in one of the kitchen chairs, hands dangling between his thighs. He looked up at Huddy and opened his mouth, but at first, nothing came out. What is it? Huddy slung the pot of macaroni onto the counter without a second look. The Buick? You the D.O. tonight, Hud? Yeah, until 11. Who else here? Couple of guys upstairs. Maybe. If you're thinking about the brass, you can stop. I'm the closest you're going to get tonight, so spill it. You come out back, Archie told him. Take a look for yourself, and bring some binoculars. Huddy snagged a pair of binocs from the supply room, but they turned out to be no help. The thing in the corner of Shed B was actually too close. In the glasses, it was just a blur. After 2 or 3 minutes of fiddling with the focus knob, Huddy gave up. I'm going in there. Archie gripped his wrist. Jesus, no, call the Sarge, let him decide. Huddy, who could be stubborn, shook his head. Sarge is sleeping. His wife called and said so. You know what it means when she does that. No one hadn't ought to wake him up unless it's World War III. What if that thing in there is World War III? I'm not worried, Huddy said. Which was, judging from his face, the lie of the decade, if not the century. He looked in again, hands cupped to the sides of his face, the useless binoculars standing on the pavement beside his left foot. It's dead. Maybe, Archie said, and maybe it's just playing possum. Huddy looked around at him. You don't mean that. A pause. Do you? I don't know what I mean and what I don't mean. I don't know if that thing's over for good or just resting up. Neither do you. What if it wants someone to go in there? You thought about that? What if it's waiting for you? Huddy thought it over, then said, I guess in that case, it'll get what it wants. He stepped back from the door, looking every bit as scared as Archie had looked when he came into the kitchen, but also looking set. Meaning it. Just a stubborn old Dutchman. Archie, listen to me. Yeah? Carl Brundage is upstairs in the common room. Also Mark Rushing, I think, anyway. Don't bother Loving and Dispatch. I don't trust him. Too wet behind the ears. But you go on and tell the other two what's up. And get that look off your face. This is probably nothing, but a little backup wouldn't hurt. Just in case it ain't nothing? Right. 'Cause it might be something? Huddy nodded. You sure? Uh-huh. Okay. Huddy walked along the front of the roll-up door, turned the corner, and stood in front of the smaller door on the side. He took a deep breath. held it in for a 5 count, let it out. Then he unsnapped the strap over the butt of his pistol, a .357 Ruger back in those days. "Huddy?" Huddy jumped. If his finger had been on the trigger instead of outside the guard, he might have blown off his own foot. He spun around and saw Arkie standing there at the corner of the shed, his big, dark eyes swimming in his pinched face.
"Lord Jesus Christ," Huddy cried. "Why the fuck are you creeping after me?"
"I wasn't creeping, Troop. Just walking, like normal."
"Go inside. Get Carl and Mike, like I told you."
Arkie shook his head. Scared or not, he had decided he wanted to be a part of what was going down. Huddy supposed he could understand. Trooper Gray did have a way of rubbing off.
"All right, you dumb Swede. Let's go."
Huddy opened the door and stepped into the shed, which was still cooler than the outside, although just how cool it might have been was impossible for either man to tell, because they were both sweating like pigs. Huddy was holding his gun up beside his right cheekbone. Arkie grabbed a rake from the pegs close by the door. It clanged against a shovel and both of them jumped. To Arkie, the look of their shadows on the wall was even worse than the sound. They seemed to leap from place to place, like the shadows of nimble goblins.
"Huddy," he began,
"shh.
If it's dead, why you go shh?"
"Don't be a smartass,"
Huddy whispered back. He started across the cement floor toward the Buick. Arkie followed with the rake handle gripped tight in his sweaty hands, his heart pounding. His mouth tasted dry and somehow burnt. He had never been so scared in his life. And the fact that he didn't know exactly what he was scared of only made it worse. Huddy got to the rear of the Buick and peeped into the open trunk. His back was so broad Arkie couldn't see around it.
"What's in there, Hud?"
"Nothing. It's clean."
Huddy reached for the trunk lid, hesitated, then shrugged and slammed it down. They both jumped at the sound and looked at the thing in the corner. It didn't stir. Huddy started toward it, gun once more held up by the side of his head. The sound of his feet shuffling on the concrete was very loud. The thing was indeed dead. The two men became more and more sure of it as they approached, but that didn't make things better because neither of them had ever seen anything like it. Not in the woods of western Pennsylvania, not in a zoo, not in a wildlife magazine. It was just different. So goddamn different. Huddy found himself thinking of horror movies he'd seen, but the thing huddled up in the angle where the shed walls met wasn't really like something from those either. Goddamn different was what he kept coming back to. What they both kept coming back to. Everything about it screamed that it wasn't from here. Here meaning not just the short hills, but all of planet Earth. Maybe the entire universe. At least as sea students in science such as themselves understood that concept. It was as if some warning circuit buried deep in their heads had suddenly awakened and begun to wail. Arkie was thinking of spiders. Not because the thing in the corner looked like a spider, but because, well, spiders were different. All those legs. And you had no idea what they might be thinking or how they could even exist. The thing was like that, only worse. It made him sick just to look at it, to try to make sense of what his eyes said they were seeing. His skin had gone clammy, his heart was missing beats, and his guts seemed to have gained weight. He wanted to run, to just turn tail and stampede out of there.
"Christ,"
Huddy said in a little moan of a voice.
"Oh, Christ."
It was as if he were pleading for it to go away. His gun sagged downward and outward until the barrel was pointed at the floor. It was only 3 pounds, but his arm could no longer support even that paltry weight. The muscles of his face also sagged, pulling his eyes wide and dropping his jaw down until his mouth opened. Arky never forgot the way Huddy's teeth gleamed in the shadows. At the same time, he began to shiver all over. And Arky became aware he was shivering too. The thing in the corner was the size of a very large bat, like the ones that roosted in Miracle Caves over in Lassburg, or the so-called Wonder Cavern, guided tours, $3 a head, special family rates available, in Pogus City. Its wings hid most of its body. They weren't folded, but lay in messy, overlapping crumples, as if it had tried to fold them, and failed before it died. The wings were either black or a very dark, mottled green. What they could see of the creature's back was a lighter green. The stomach area was a cheesy, whitey shade, like the gut of a rotted stump or the throat of a decaying swamp lily. The triangular head was cocked to one side. A bony thing that might have been a nose or a beak jutted from the eyeless face. Below it, the creature's mouth hung open. A yellowish rope of tissue dangled from it as if the thing had been regurgitating its last meal as it died. Huddy took one look and knew he wouldn't be eating any more macaroni and cheese for a while. Beneath the corpse, spread around its hindquarters, was a thin puddle of congealing black goo. The idea that any such substance could serve as blood made Huddy feel like crying out. He thought, I won't touch it. I'd kill my own mother before I'd touch that thing. He was still thinking that when a long wooden rod slid into his peripheral vision. He gave a little shriek and flinched back. Arky, don't! He yelled, but it was too late. Later on, Arky was unable to say just why he had prodded the thing in the corner. It was simply some strong urge to which he had given in before he was completely aware of what he was doing. When the end of the rake handle touched the place where the wings were crumpled across each other, there was a sound like rustling paper and a bad smell, like old stewed cabbage. The two of them barely noticed. The top of the thing's face seemed to peel back, revealing a dead and glassy eye that looked as big as a factory ball bearing. Arky backed away, dropping the rake with a clatter and putting both hands over his mouth. Above the spread fingers, his eyes had begun to ooze terrified tears. Huddy simply stood where he was, locked in place.
It was an eyelid, he said in a low, hoarse voice. Just an eyelid, that's all. You joggled it with the rake, you goddamn fool. You joggled it, and it rolled back.
Christ, Huddy,
it's dead.
Christ, Jesus, God,
it's dead, okay?
Oh, okay,
Arky said in that crazy Swedish accent of his. It was thicker than it had ever been.
Let's get out of here.
You're pretty smart for a janitor.
The two of them headed back for the door, slowly backing up, not wanting to lose sight of the thing. Also because both of them knew they would lose control and bolt if they actually saw the door. The safety of the door. The promise of a sane world beyond the door. Getting there seemed to take forever. Arky backed out first and began taking huge gasps of the fresh evening air. Huddy came out behind him and slammed the door. And for a moment, the two of them just looked at each other. Arky had gone past white and directly to yellow. To Huddy, he looked like a cheese sandwich without the bread.
What you laughing about? Arky asked him. What's so funny?
Nothing, Huddy said. I'm just trying not to be hysterical.
You gonna call Sergeant Shane Dinks now?
Huddy nodded. He kept thinking about how the whole top half of the thing's head had seemed to peel back when Arky prodded it. He had an idea he'd be revisiting that moment in his dreams later on, and that turned out to be absolutely correct.
What about Curtis?
Huddy thought about it and shook his head. Kurt had a young wife. Young wives liked to have their husbands home, and when they didn't get what they wanted for at least a few nights in a row, they were apt to get hurt feelings and ask questions. It was natural. As it was natural for young husbands to sometimes answer their questions, even when they knew they weren't supposed to.
Just a Sarge, then?
No, Huddy said. Let's get Sandy Dearborn in on this, too. Sandy's got a good head.
Sandy was still in the parking lot at Jimmy's Diner with his radar gun in his lap when his radio spoke up.
Unit 14, Unit 14.
14. As always, Sandy had glanced at his watch when he heard his unit number. It was 7:20.
Could you return to base 14? We have a decode, say again, a decode copy?
3?
Sandy asked. In most American police forces, 3 means emergency.
No, negative, but we sure could use some help.
Roger.
He got back about 10 minutes before the Sarge arrived in his personal, which happened to be an International Harvester pickup even older than Arky's Ford. By then, the word had already started to spread, and Sandy saw a regular trooper convention in front of Shed B. Lots of guys at the windows, all of them peering in.
Brundage and Rushing, Cole and Devo, Huddy Royer.
Arky Arcanian was pacing around in little circles behind them with his hands stuffed forearm deep in his pants pockets and lines climbing his forehead like the rungs of a ladder. He wasn't waiting for a window, though. Arky had seen all he wanted to, at least for one night. Huddy filled Sandy in on what had happened, and then Sandy had his own good long look at the thing in the corner. He also tried to guess what the sergeant might want when he arrived and put the items in a cardboard box near the side door. Tony pulled in, parked askew behind the old school bus, and came jogging across to Shed B. He elbowed Carl Brundage unceremoniously away from the window that was closest to the dead creature and stared at it while Huddy made his report. When Huddy was done, Tony called Arky over and listened to Arky's version of the story. Sandy thought that Tony's methods of handling the roadmaster were put to the test that evening and proved sound. All through his debriefing of Huddy and Arky, Troop D personnel were showing up. Most of the men were off duty. Those few in uniform had been close enough to come in for a look-see when they heard Huddy give the code for the Buick. Yet there was no loud crosstalk. No jostling for position. No men getting in the way of Tony's investigation or gumming things up with a lot of stupid questions. Above all, there were no flaring tempers and no panic. If reporters had been there and experienced the atavistic power of that thing, a thing which remained awful and somehow threatening even though it was obviously dead, Sandy dreaded to think about what the consequences might have been. When he mentioned that to Shandinks the next day, the sergeant laughed.
"The Cardiff Giant in hell," he said. "That would have been your consequence, Sandy."
Both of them, the sergeant who was and the sergeant who would be, knew what the press called such information management, at least when the managers were cops. Fascism. That was a little heavy, no doubt, but neither of them actually questioned the fact that all sorts of abuses lay a turn or two down that road.
"You want to see cops out of control, look at L.A., Tony said once. "For every 3 good ones, you got 2 Hitler youth dingbats on motorcycles."
The business of the Buick was a bona fide special case, however. Neither of them questioned that, either. Huddy wanted to know if he'd been right not to call Curtis. He was worried Kurt would feel left out, passed over. If the sarge wanted, Huddy said, he could go in the barracks that very second and make a telephone call, happy to do it. "Curtis is fine right where he is," Tony said. "And when it's explained to him why he wasn't called, he'll understand. As for the rest of you fellows." Tony stepped away from the roll-up door. His posture was easy and relaxed, but his face was very pale. The sight of that thing in the corner had affected him, too, even through a pane of glass. Sandy felt the same way himself. But he could also sense Sergeant Shandink's excitement, the balls-to-the-wall curiosity he shared with Kurt. The throbbing undertone that said, "Holy shit, do you fucking believe it?" Sandy heard it and recognized it for what it was, although he felt none of it himself, not a single iota. He didn't think any of the others did either. Certainly Huddy's curiosity and Arky's had faded quickly enough. "Gone the way of the blue suede shoe," as Curtis might have said. "You men on duty, listen up to me now," Tony said. He was wearing his slanted little grin, but to Sandy it looked a bit forced that night. "There's fires in Statler, floods in Leesburg, and a rash of Piggly Wiggly robberies down in Pogus County. We suspect the Amish." There was some laughter at this. "So what are you waiting for?" There was a general exodus of troopers on duty, followed by the sound of Chevrolet V8 engines starting up. The off-duty fellows hung around for a while, but nobody had to tell them to move along. "Move along. Come on, boys. Show's over." Sandy asked the sarge if he should also saddle up and ride. "No, trooper," he said. "You're with me." And he started briskly toward the walk-in door, pausing only long enough to examine the items Sandy had put into the carton. One of the evidence documenting Polaroids, extra film, a yardstick, and evidence collection kit. Sandy had also grabbed a couple of green plastic garbage bags from the kitchenette. "Good job, Sandy." "Thanks, sir." "Ready to go in?" "Yes, sir." "Scared?" "Yes, sir." "Scared as me or not quite that scared?" "I don't know." "Me either. But I'm scared, all right. If I faint, you catch me." "Just fall in my direction, sir," he laughed. "Come on. Step into my parlor," said the spider to the fly. Scared or not, the two of them made a pretty thorough investigation. They collaborated on a diagram of the shed's interior, and when Kurt later complimented Sandy on it, Sandy nodded and agreed that it had been a good one. Good enough to take into court, actually. Still, a lot of the lines on it were wavery. Their hands began to shake almost from the moment they entered the shed and didn't stop until they were back out again. They opened the trunk because it had been open when Arky first looked in, and although it was empty as ever, they took Polaroids of it. They likewise photoed the thermometer, which by then had gotten all the way up to 70 degrees, mostly because Tony thought Kurt would want them to. And they took pictures of the corpse in the corner, took them from every angle they could think of. Every Polaroid showed that unspeakable single eye. It was shiny, like fresh tar. Seeing himself reflected in it made Sandy Dearborn feel like screaming. And every 2 or 3 seconds, one of them would look back over his shoulder at the Buick Roadmaster. When they were done with the photos, some of which they took with the yardstick lying beside the corpse, Tony shook out one of the garbage bags. "Get a shovel," he said. "Don't you want to leave it where it is until Kurt?"
"Probationary Trooper Wilcox can look at it down in the supply closet," Tony said.
His voice was oddly tight, strangled almost, and Sandy realized he was working very hard not to be sick. Sandy's own stomach took a queasy little lurch, perhaps in sympathy. "He can look at it there to his heart's content. For once, we don't have to worry about breaking the chain of evidence because no district attorney is ever going to be involved. Meantime, we're scooping this shit up." He wasn't shouting, but a raw little edge had come into his voice. Sandy took a shovel from where it hung on the wall and slid the blade beneath the dead creature. The wings made a papery and somehow terrible crackling sound. Then one of them fell back, revealing a black and hairless side. For the second time since the two of them had stepped in, Sandy felt like screaming. He could not have told why exactly, but there was something deep down in his head,
begging not to be shown any more. And all the time, they were smelling it, that sour, cabbagey reek. Sandy observed sweat standing out all over Tony Shandink's forehead in fine little dots. Some of these had broken and run down his cheeks, leaving tracks like tears.
"Go on," he said, holding the bag open. "Go on now, Sandy. Drop it in there before I lose my groceries."
Sandy tilted it into the bag and felt a little bit better when the weight slid off the shovel. After Tony had gotten a sack of the liquid-absorbing red sawdust they kept for oil spills and sprinkled it over the gooey stain in the corner, both of them felt better. Tony twirled the top of the garbage bag with the creature inside, then knotted it. Once that was done, the two of them started backing toward the door. Tony stopped just before they reached it. "Photo that," he said, pointing to a place high on the roll-up door behind the Buick, the door through which Johnny Parker had towed the car in the first place. To Tony Shandinks and Sandy Dearborn, that already seemed like a long time ago.
"And that, and there, and over there."
At first, Sandy didn't see what the Sarge was pointing at. He looked away, blinked his eyes once or twice, then looked back. And there it was. Three or four dark green smudges that made Sandy think of the dust that rubs off a moth's wings. As kids, they had solemnly assured each other that moth dust was deadly poison. It would blind you if you got some on your fingers and then rubbed your eyes.
"You see what happened, don't you?" Tony asked as Sandy raised the Polaroid and sighted in on the first mark.
The camera seemed very heavy and his hands were still shivering, but he got it done.
"No, Sarge, I don't guess I do. Whatever that thing is, bird, bat, some kind of robot, drone, it flew out of the trunk when the lid came open. It hit the back door, that's the first smudge, and then it started bouncing off the walls. You ever seen a bird that gets caught in a shed or a barn?"
Sandy nodded.
"Like that."
Tony wiped sweat off his forehead and looked at Sandy. It was a look the younger man never forgot. He had never seen the Sarge's eyes so naked. It was, he thought, the look you sometimes saw on the faces of small children when you came to break up a domestic disturbance.
"Man," Tony said heavily. "Fuck."
Sandy nodded. Tony looked down at the bag.
"You think it looks like a bat?"
"Yeah," Sandy said. Then, "No." After another pause, he added,
"Bullshit."
Tony barked a laugh that sounded somehow haggard.
"That's very definitive. If you were on the witness stand, no defense attorney could peel that back."
"I don't know, Tony."
What Sandy did know was that he wanted to stop shooting the shit and get back out into the open air.
"What do you think?"
"Well, if I drew it, it'd look like a bat," Tony said. "The Polaroids we took also make it look like a bat. But I don't know exactly how to say it, but it doesn't feel like a bat," Sandy said.
Tony smiled bleakly and pointed a finger at Sandy like a gun.
"Very zen, Grasshopper. But those marks on the wall suggest it at least acted like a bat, or a trap bird.
Flew around in here until it dropped dead in the corner. Shit, for all we know, it died of fright." Sandy recalled the glaring dead eye, a thing almost too alien to look at, and thought that for the first time in his life, he could really understand the concept Sergeant Shandinks had articulated. Die of fright? Yes, it could be done. It really could. Then, because the Sarge seemed to be waiting for something, he said,
"Or maybe it hit the wall so hard it broke its neck."
Another idea came to him.
"Or, listen, Tony, maybe the air killed it."
"Say what?"
"Maybe..."
But Tony's eyes had lit up and he was nodding.
"Sure," he said. "Maybe the air on the other side of the Buick's trunk is different air. Maybe it'd taste like poison gas to us.
rupture our lungs. For Sandy, that was enough. I have to get out of here, Tony, or I'm going to be the one who throws up. But what he really felt in danger of was choking, not vomiting. All at once, the normally broad avenue of his windpipe was down to a pinhole. Once they were back outside, it was nearly dark by then, and an incredibly sweet summer breeze had sprung up. Sandy felt better. He had an idea Tony did, too. Certainly some of the color had come back into the sergeant's cheeks. Huddy and a few other troopers came over to the two of them as Tony shut the walk-in side door. But nobody said anything. An outsider with no context upon which to draw might have looked at those faces and thought that the president had died or war had been declared. "Sandy?" Tony asked. "Any better now?" "Yeah." He nodded at the garbage bag, hanging like a dead pendulum with its strange weight at the bottom. "You really think it might have been our air that killed it?" "It's possible. Or maybe just the shock of finding itself in our world. I don't think I could live for long in the world this thing came from, tell you that much. Even if I could breathe the..." Tony stopped, because all at once, Sandy looked bad again. Terrible, in fact. "Sandy, what is it? What's wrong?" Sandy wasn't sure he wanted to tell his SC what was wrong. Wasn't even sure he could. What he'd thought of was Ennis Rafferty. The idea of the missing trooper added to what they had just discovered in Shed B suggested a conclusion that Sandy didn't want to consider. Once it had come into his mind, though, it was hard to get it back out. If the Buick was a conduit to some other world, and the Bat Thing had gone through it in one direction, then Ennis Rafferty had almost certainly gone through in the other. "Sandy, talk to me." "Nothing wrong, boss," Sandy replied, then had to bend over and grip his shins in both hands. It was a good way to stop yourself from fainting, always assuming you had enough time to use it. The others stood around watching him, still saying nothing, still wearing those long faces that said, "The king is dead. Long live the king." At last the world steadied again, and Sandy straightened up. "I'm okay," he said. "Really." Tony considered his face, then nodded. He lifted the green bag slightly. "This is going into the storage closet off the supply room, the little one where Andy Colucci keeps his stroke books." A few nervous titters greeted this. "That room is going to be off limits except for myself, Curtis Wilcox, and Sandy Dearborn. BPO, people. Got it?" They nodded. "By permission only. Sandy, Curtis, and me. This is now our investigation, so designated." He stood straight in the gathering gloom, almost at attention, holding the garbage bag in one hand and the Polaroids in the other. "This stuff is evidence, of what I have no current idea. If any of you come up with any ideas, bring them to me. If they seem like crazy ideas to you, bring them to me even quicker. That's a crazy situation. But crazy or not, we will roll this case. Roll it as we would any other. Questions?" There were no questions. Or if you wanted to look at it the other way, Sandy reflected, there was nothing but questions. "We ought to have a man in that shed as much as we can," Tony said. "Guard duty, Sarge?" Steve Devo asked. "Let's call it surveillance," Tony said. "Come on, Sandy, stick with me until I get this thing stowed. I don't want to take it downstairs by myself, and that's the God's truth." As they started across the parking lot, Sandy heard Archie Arcanian saying that Kurt was going to get mad he didn't get called. Wait and see, that boy was going to be madder and a wet hen. But Curtis was too excited to be mad, too busy trying to prioritize the things he wanted to do, too full of questions. He asked only one of those before pelting down to look at the corpse of the creature they'd found in Shed B. Where had Mr. Dillon been last evening? With Orville, he was told. Orville Garrett often took Mr. D when he had a few days off. Sandy Dearborn was the one who brought Curtis up to speed, with occasional help from Archie. Kurt listened silently, brows lifting when Archie described how the whole top of the thing's head had appeared to roll back, disclosing the eye. They lifted again when Sandy told him about the smudges on the door and the walls, and how they had reminded him of moth dust. He asked his question about Mr. D, got his answer, then grabbed a pair of surgical gloves out of an evidence kit and headed downstairs at what was nearly a run. Sandy went with him. That much seemed to be his duty somehow, since Tony had appointed him a co-investigator. But he stayed in the supply room while Kurt went into the closet where Tony had left the garbage bag. Sandy heard it rustling as Kurt undid the knot in the top. His skin prickled and went cold at the sound. Rustle, rustle, rustle. Pause. Another rustle. Then very low. Christ almighty. A moment later, Kurt came running out with his hand over his mouth. There was a toilet halfway down the hall leading to the stairs. Trooper Wilcox made it just in time. Sandy Dearborn sat at the cluttered work table in the supply room, listening to him vomit and knowing that the vomiting probably meant nothing in the larger scheme of things. Curtis wasn't going to back off. The corpse of the bat thing had revolted him as much as it had Archie or Huddy or any of them, but he'd come back to examine it more fully. Revulsion or no revulsion. The Buick and the things of the Buick had become his passion. Even coming out of the storage closet with his throat working and his cheeks pale and his hand pressed to his mouth, Sandy had seen the helpless excitement in his eyes, dimmed only a little by his physical distress. Passion is the hardest taskmaster. From down the hall came the sound of running water. It stopped, and then Kurt came back into the supply room, blotting his mouth with a paper towel. "Pretty awful, isn't it?" Sandy asked. "Even dead." "Pretty awful," he agreed, but he was heading back in there even as he spoke. "I thought I understood, but it caught me by surprise." Sandy got up and went to the doorway. Kurt was looking into the bag again, but not reaching in. Not yet, at least. That was a relief. Sandy didn't want to be around when the kid touched it, even wearing gloves. Didn't even want to think about him touching it. "Was it a trade, do you think?" Kurt asked. "Huh? A trade. Ennis for this thing." For a moment, Sandy didn't reply. Couldn't reply. Not because the idea was horrible, although it was, but because the kid had gotten to it so fast. "I don't know." Kurt was rocking back and forth on the heels of his shoes and frowning down at the plastic garbage bag. "I don't think so," he said after a while. "When you make a swap, you usually do the whole deal at the same time, right?" "Usually, yeah." He closed the bag and, with obvious reluctance, re-knotted the top. "I'm going to dissect it," he said. "Curtis, no! Christ!" "Yes." He turned to Sandy, his face drawn and white, his eyes brilliant. "Someone has to, and I can't very well take it up to the biology department at Horlicks. Sarge says we keep this strictly in-house, and that's the right call, but who does that leave to do this?" "Just me, unless I'm missing something." Sandy thought, "You wouldn't take it up to Horlicks even if Tony hadn't said a goddamn word about keeping it in-house. You can bear to have us in on it probably because nobody but Tony really wants anything to do with it, but share it with someone else? Someone who doesn't wear Pennsylvania gray and know when to shift the hat strap from the back of the head to under the chin? Someone who might first get ahead of you and then take it away from you? I don't think so." Kurt stripped off the gloves. "The problem is that I haven't cut anything up since Chauncey,
my fetal pig in high school biology. That was 9 years ago, and I got a C on the course. I don't want to fuck this up, Sandy.
Then don't touch it in the first place. Sandy thought it but didn't say it. There would have been no point in saying it. Oh, well, the kid talking to himself now, nobody but himself. I'll bone up. Get ready. I've got time. No sense being impatient. Curiosity killed the cat, but satisfaction. What if that's a lie? Sandy asked. He was surprised at how tired of that little jingle-jangle he had grown. What if there's no satisfaction? What if you're never able to solve for X? Kurt looked up at him, almost shocked. Then he grinned.
What do you think Ennis would say? If we could ask him, that is.
Sandy found the question both patronizing and insensitive. He opened his mouth to say so, to say something anyway, and then didn't. Curtis Wilcox didn't mean any harm. He was just flying high on adrenaline and possibly as hyped as any junkie. And he really was a kid. Even Sandy recognized that, although they were much of an age.
Ennis would tell you to be careful, Sandy said.
I'm sure of that much.
I will, Kurt agreed, starting up the stairs.
Oh, yeah. Of course I will. But those were just words, like the doxology you rush through in order to get free of church on Sunday morning. Sandy knew it, even if probationary trooper Wilcox did not.
In the weeks that followed, it became obvious to Tony Shaindinks, not to mention the rest of the Troop D personnel, that there wasn't enough manpower to institute 24-hour surveillance of the Buick in the shed out back. Nor did the weather cooperate. The second half of that August was rainy and unseasonably cold. Visitors added another headache. Troop D didn't live in a vacuum on top of its hill, after all. The motor pool was next door. The county attorney, plus his staff, was just down the road. There were lawyers. There were perps cooling their heels in the bad boy corner. The occasional Boy Scout tour, the steady trickle of folks who wanted to lodge complaints against their neighbors, against their spouses, against Amish buggy drivers taking too much of the road, against the state troopers themselves, wives bringing forgotten lunches or sometimes boxes of fudge, and sometimes just interested John Qs who wanted to look at what their tax dollars were buying. These latter were usually surprised and disappointed by the calmness of the barracks, the ho-hum sense of bureaucracy at work. It didn't feel like their favorite TV shows. One day toward the end of that month, Statler's member of the United States House of Representatives dropped by, along with 10 or 12 of his closest media friends, to do a meet-and-greet and to make a statement about the police aid, science, and infrastructure bill then pending before the House, a bill this fellow just happened to be co-sponsoring. Like many U.S. representatives from rural districts, this fellow looked like a small-town barber who had a lucky day at the dog track and hoped for a blowjob before bedtime. Standing beside one of the cruisers, Sandy thought it was the one with the busted headrest, he told his media friends how important the police were, especially the fine men and women of the Pennsylvania State Police, most especially the fine men and women of Troop D. That was a bit of information shortfall, there being no female troopers or PCOs in D at that time. But none of the troopers offered a correction, at least not while the cameras were rolling. They were, the representative said, a thin gray line dividing Mr. and Mrs. John Q. taxpayer from the evil of the chaos gang, and so on and so on. God bless America, may all your children grow up to play the violin. Captain Dimit came down from Butler, presumably because someone felt his stripes would lend a little extra tone to the event, and he later told Tony Shaindinks in a low growl, "That toupee-wearing touch-hole asked me to fix his wife's speeding ticket." And all the time the representative was blathering and the entourage was touring and the reporters were reporting and the cameras were rolling, the Buick Roadmaster was sitting just 50 yards away,
blue as deep dusk on its fat and luxy white walls. It sat under the big round thermometer Tony and Kurt had mounted on one of the beams. It sat there, with its zeroed odometer, and dirt wouldn't stick to it. To the troopers who knew about it, the damn thing felt like an itch between the shoulder blades, the one place you can't quite reach. There was bad weather to contend with. There were all kinds of John Qs to contend with, many who came to praise the family but who weren't of the family. And there were also visiting police officers and troopers from other barracks. These last were in some ways the most dangerous, because cops had sharp eyes and nosy minds. What might they have thought if they'd seen a trooper in a rain slicker or a certain janitor with a Swedish accent standing out there by Shed B, like one of those big-hat soldiers guarding the gate at Buckingham Palace, occasionally walking over to the roll-up door and peering inside? Might a visiting policeman seeing this have been curious about what was in there? Does a bear shit in the woods? Kurt solved this as well as it could be solved. He sent Tony a memo that said it was a shame the way the raccoons kept getting into our garbage and scattering it around, and that Phil Candleton and Brian Cole had agreed to build a little hutch to store the garbage cans in. Kurt thought that out behind Shed B would be a good place for it, if the SC agreed. S.C. Shandinks wrote OK across the top of the memo, and that one did get filed. What the memo neglected to mention was that the troop hadn't had any real problems with coons since Archie bought a couple of plastic garbage cans from Sears, the kind with the snap-down tops. The hutch was built, painted PSP gray, of course, and ready for action 3 days after the memo landed in Tony's in-basket. Prefab and purely functional, it was just big enough for two garbage cans, three shelves, and one state trooper sitting on a kitchen chair. It served the dual purpose of keeping the troopers on watch, A, out of the weather, and B, out of sight. Every 10 or 15 minutes, the man on duty would get up, leave the hutch, and look through one of the windows in Shed B's rear roll-up door. The hutch was stocked with soda, munchies, magazines, and a galvanized pail. The pail had a paper strip reading, "I could not hold it any longer," taped to the side. That was Jackie O'Hara's touch. The others called him the Irish Wonder Boy, and he never failed to make them laugh. He was making them laugh even 3 years later as he lay in his bedroom, dying of esophageal cancer. Eyes glassy with morphine, telling stories about Paddy and the Bog Trotter in a hoarse whisper, while his old mates visited and sometimes held his hand when the pain was especially bad. Later on, there would be plenty of video cameras at Troop D, at all the PSP barracks, because by the 90s, all the cruisers were equipped with dashboard-mounted Panasonic eyewitness models. These were made specially for law enforcement organizations and came without mics. Video of road stops was legal. Because of existing wiretap laws, audio was not. But all of that was later. In the late summer of 1979, they had to make do with a video cam Huddy Royer had gotten for his birthday. They kept it on one of the shelves out in the hutch, stored in its box, and wrapped in plastic to make sure it stayed dry. Another box contained extra batteries and a dozen blank tapes with the cellophane stripped off so they'd be ready to go. There was also a slate with a number chalked on it, the current temperature inside the shed. If the person on duty noticed a change, he erased the last observation, wrote in the current one, and added a chalk arrow pointing either up or down. It was the closest thing to a written record Sergeant Shandinks would allow. Tony seemed delighted with this jury rig. Kurt tried to emulate him, but sometimes his worry and frustration broke through. "There won't be anyone on watch the next time something happens," he said.
You wait and see if I'm not right. It's always the way. Nobody will volunteer from midnight to four some night, and whoever comes on next will look in and see the trunk lit up and another dead bat on the floor. You wait and see.
Kurt tried persuading Tony to at least keep a surveillance sign-up sheet. There was no shortage of volunteers, he argued. What they were short on was organization and scheduling, things that would be easy to change. Tony remained adamant. No paper trail. When Kurt volunteered to take over more of the sentry duty himself, many of the troopers took to calling it Hutch Patrol. Tony refused and told him to ease off.
You've got other responsibilities, he said. Not the least of them is your wife.
Kurt had the good sense to keep quiet while in the SC's office. Later, however, he unburdened himself to Sandy, speaking with surprising bitterness as the two of them stood outside at the far corner of the barracks.
If I'd wanted a marriage counselor, I would have consulted the goddamn yellow pages, he said.
Sandy offered him a smile, one without much humor in it. I think you better start listening for the pop, he said.
What are you talking about?
The pop. Very distinctive sound. You hear it when your head finally comes out of your ass. Curtis stared at him, hard little roses of color burning high up on his cheekbones.
Am I missing something here, Sandy?
Yes.
What? Oh, for God's sake, what?
Your job and your life, Sandy said. Not necessarily in that order. You are experiencing a problem of perspective. That Buick is starting to look too big to you.
Too?
Kurt hit his forehead with the palm of his hand in that way he had. Then he turned and looked out at the short hills. At last he swung back to Sandy.
It's something from another world, Sandy. From another world. How can a thing like that look too big?
That's exactly your problem, Sandy replied. Your problem of perspective. He had an idea that the next thing Curtis said would be the beginning of an argument, possibly a bitter one. So before Kurt could say anything, Sandy went inside. And perhaps that talk did some good, because as August gave way to September, Kurt's all but constant request for more surveillance time stopped. Sandy Dearborn never tried to tell himself that the kid had seen the light, but he did seem to understand that he'd gone as far as he could, at least for the time being. Which was good, but maybe not quite good enough. Sandy thought that the Buick was always going to look too big to Curtis. But then, there have always been two sorts of people in the world. Kurt was of the sort who believed satisfaction actually did bring felines back from the other side of the Great Divide. He began to show up at the barracks with biology books instead of Field and Stream. The one most commonly observed under his arm or lying on the toilet tank in the crapper was Dr. John H. Maturin's 20 Elementary Dissections, Harvard University Press, 1968. When Buck Flanders and his wife went over to Kurt's for dinner one evening, Michelle Wilcox complained about her husband's gross new hobby. He had started getting specimens from a medical supply house, she said, and the area of the basement, which he had designated as his darkroom to be only the year before, now smelled of mortuary chemicals. Kurt started with mice and a guinea pig, then moved on to birds, eventually working his way up to a horned owl. Sometimes he brought specimens to work. "You haven't really lived," Matt Babicki told Orville Garrett and Steve Devo one day, "until you go downstairs for a fresh box of ballpoint pens and find a jar of formaldehyde with an owl eye in it sitting on top of the Xerox machine. Man, that wakes you up." Once the owl had been conquered, Curtis moved on to bats. He did 8 or 9 of those, each specimen from a different species. A couple he caught himself in his backyard. The rest he ordered from a biological supply house in the Berg. Sandy never forgot the day Curtis showed him a South American vampire bat pinned to a board. The thing was furry, brownish on the belly, and velvet black on the membranous wings. Its tiny pointed teeth were bared in a psychotic smile. Its guts were laid open in a teardrop shape by Kurt's increasingly skilled technique. Sandy believed Kurt's high school biology teacher, the one who had given him the C, would have been surprised at how fast his old student was learning. Of course, when desire drives, any fool can be a professor. It was while Kurt Wilcox was learning the fine art of dissection from Dr. Maturin that Jimmy and Rosalind took up residence in the Buick 8. They were Tony's brainstorm. He had it one day at the Tri-Town Mall while his wife tried on clothes in country casuals. An improbable sign in the window of My Pet caught his eye. Come on in and join our gerbil riot. Tony didn't join the gerbil riot just then. His wife would have had 1,000 questions. But he sent Big George Stankowski back the very next day with more cash from the contingency fund and orders to buy a pair of gerbils. Also a plastic habitat for them to live in.
Should I get them some food, too? George asked.
No, Tony answered. Absolutely not. We're going to buy a couple of gerbils and then let them starve to death out in the shed.
Really? That seems sort of mean to...
Tony sighed. Get them food, George, yes. By all means, get them food. The only specification Tony made concerning the habitat was that it fit comfortably on the Buick's front seat. George got a nice one, not top of the line, but almost. It was made of a yellow, see-through plastic and consisted of a long corridor with a boxy room at either end. One was the gerbil dining room, and the other was the gerbil version of Gold's Gym. The dining room had a food trough and a water bottle clipped to the side. The gym had an exercise wheel.
They live better than some people, Orvie Garrett said.
Phil, who was watching Rosalind take a shit in the food trough, said,
Speak for yourself.
Dickie Duck Elliott, perhaps not the swiftest horse ever to canter around life's great racetrack, wanted to know why we were keeping gerbils in the Buick. Wasn't that sort of dangerous?
Well, we'll see about that, won't we? Tony asked in an oddly gentle voice. We'll just see if it is or not.
On a day not long after Troop D acquired Jimmy and Rosalind, Tony Shaindinks crossed his own personal Rubicon and lied to the press. Not that the representative of the Fourth Estate in this case was very impressive, just a weedy, red-headed boy of 20 or so, a summer intern at the Statler County American, who would be going back to Ohio State in another week or so. He had a way of listening to you with his mouth hung partway open that made him look, in Arky's words, like a stark, raving, natural-born fool. But he wasn't a fool, and he'd spent most of one golden September afternoon listening to Mr. Bradley Roach. Brad gave the young reporter quite an earful about the man with the Russian accent. By this time, Brad was positive the guy had been Russian, and the car the man had left behind. The weedy redhead, Homer Usler by name, wanted to do a feature story on all of this and go back to college with a bang. Sandy thought the young man could imagine a front-page headline with the words, Mystery Car, in it. Perhaps even, Russian Spies Mystery Car. Tony never hesitated, just went ahead and lied. He undoubtedly would have done the same thing even if the reporter presenting himself that day had been case-hardened old Trevor Ronick, who owned the County American, and had forgotten more stories than the redhead would ever write.
Car's gone, Tony said, and there it was.
Lie told, Rubicon crossed.
Gone?
Homer Usler asked, clearly disappointed. He had a big old Minolta camera on his lap. Property of County American was dymo-taped across the back of the case.
Gone where?
State Impound Bureau, Tony said, creating this impressive-sounding organization on the spot. In Philly.
Why?
They auction unclaimed rolling iron, after they search him for drugs, of course.
course. Do you have any paperwork on it?
Must have, Tony said. Got it on everything else. I'll look for it, give you a ring.
Well, how long you think that'll take, Sergeant Chaindinks?
A while, son.
Tony waved his hand at his in-out basket, which was stacked high with papers. Usler didn't need to know that most of them were the week's junk-a-log from Scranton. Everything from updates on retirement benefits to the schedule for autumn softball. And would be in the wastebasket before the Sarge went home. That weary wave of the hand suggested that there were similar piles of paper everywhere.
Hard keeping up with all this stuff, you know. They say things will change when we start getting computerized, but that won't be this year.
I go back to school next week.
Tony leaned forward in his chair and looked at Usler keenly.
And I hope you work hard, he said. It's a tough world out there, son, but if you work hard, you can make it.
A couple of days after Homer Usler's visit, the Buick fired up another of its light storms. This time it happened on a day that was filled with bright sun, but it was still pretty spectacular. And all Curtis's worries about missing the next manifestation proved groundless. The shed's temperature made it clear the Buick was building up to something again, dropping from the mid-70s to the upper 50s over a course of 5 days. Everyone became anxious to take a turn out in the hutch. Everyone wanted to be the one on duty when it happened, whatever it turned out to be this time. Brian Cole won the lottery, but all the troopers at the barracks shared the experience at least to some extent. Brian went into Shed B at around 2 p.m. to check on Jimmy and Rosalind. They were fine as paint. Rosalind in the Habitat's dining room, and Jimmy busting heavies on the exercise wheel in the gym. But as Brian leaned farther into the Buick to check the water reservoir, he heard a humming noise. It was deep and steady, the kind of sound that vibrates your eyes in their sockets and rattles your fillings. Below it, or entwined with it, was something a lot more disturbing, a kind of scaly, wordless whispering. A purple glow, very dim, was spreading slowly across the dashboard and the steering wheel. Mindful of Ennis Rafferty gone no forwarding for well over a month by then, Trooper Cole vacated the Buick's vicinity in a hurry. He proceeded without panic, however, taking the video camera from the hutch, screwing it onto its tripod, loading in a fresh tape, checking the time code, it was correct, and the battery level all the way in the green. He turned on the overheads before going back out, then placed the tripod in front of one of the windows, hit the record button, and double-checked to make sure the Buick was centered in the viewfinder. It was. He started toward the barracks, then snapped his fingers and went back to the hutch. There was a little bag filled with camera accessories in there. One of them was a brightness filter. Brian attached this to the video camera's lens without bothering to hit the pause button. For one moment, the big dark shapes of his hands blot out the image of the Buick, and when they leave the frame again, the Buick reappears as if in a deep twilight. If there had been anyone there watching him go about his business, one of those visiting John Q's curious about how his tax dollars were spent, perhaps, he never would have guessed how fast Trooper Cole's heart was beating. He was afraid as well as excited. But he did okay. When it comes to dealing with the unknown, there's a great deal to be said for a good shot of police training. All in all, he forgot only one thing. He poked his head into Tony's office at about 2:07 and said, "Sarge, I'm pretty sure something's happening with Buick." Tony looked up from his yellow legal pad where he was scribbling the first draft of a speech he was supposed to give at a law enforcement symposium that fall and said, "What's that in your hand, Bri?" Ryan looked down and saw he was holding the gerbil's water reservoir. "Ah, what the hell," he said.
They may not need it anymore anyway. By 20 after 2, troopers in the barracks could hear the humming clearly. Not that there were many in there. Most were lined up at the windows in Shed B's two roll-up doors, hip to hip and shoulder to shoulder. Tony saw this, debated whether or not to order them away, and finally decided to let them stay where they were, with one exception. Arky?
Yes, sir, Sarge.
I want you to go out front and mow the lawn.
I just mow it on Monday.
I know. Seemed like you spent the last hour doing the part under my office window. I want you to do it again just the same, with this in your back pocket. He handed Arky a walkie-talkie. And if anyone comes calling who shouldn't see 10 Pennsylvania State Troopers lined up in front of that shed like there was a big-money cockfight going on inside, shoot me the word. Got it?
Yeah, you betcha.
Good. Matt.
Matt Babicki, front and center.
Matt rushed up, puffing and red-faced with excitement. Tony asked him where Kurt was. Matt said he was on patrol. Tell him to return to base, code D, and ride quiet. Got that?
Code D and ride quiet. Roger.
To ride quiet is to travel sans flashers and siren. Kurt presumably obeyed this injunction, but he was still back at the barracks by 2:45. No one dared ask him how far he'd come in half an hour. However many miles it might have been, he arrived alive and before the silent fireworks started up again. The first thing he did was to remove the video cam from the tripod. Until the fireworks were over, the visual record would be Curtis Wilcox's baby. The tape, one of many squirreled away in the storage closet, preserves what there was to see and hear. The Buick's hum is very audible, sounding like a loose wire in a stereo speaker, and it gets appreciably louder as time passes. Kurt got footage of the big thermometer with its red needle standing just a hair past 54. There's Kurt's voice, asking permission to go in and check on Jimmy and Rosalind, and Sergeant Chaindig's voice coming back with, "Permission denied," almost at once, brisk and sure, brooking no argument. At 3:08:41, according to the time code on the bottom of the screen, a blush like a violet sunrise begins to rise on the Buick's windshield. At first, a viewer might pass this phenomenon off as a technical glitch, or an optical illusion, or perhaps some sort of reflection. Andy Colucci.
What's that?
Unknown speaker. A power surge or a... Curtis Wilcox. Those of you with goggles, better put them on. Those of you without them, this is risky. I'd back the hell off. We have... Jackie O'Hara, probably.
Who took...
Phil Candleton, probably.
My God!
Huddy Royer. I don't think we should... Sergeant Commanding Shaindinks, sounding as calm as an Audubon guide on a nature hike. Get those goggles down, fellas. I would. Chop, chop. At 3:09:24, that violet light took an auroral leap in all the Buick's windows, turning them into brilliant, purple mirrors. If one slows the tape down and then advances it frame by frame, one can see actual reflections appearing in the formerly clear window glass. The tools hung on their pegs, the orange plow blade stored against one wall, the men outside, peering in. Most are wearing goggles and look like aliens in a cheap science fiction movie. One can isolate Kurt because of the video camera blocking the left side of his face. The hum gets louder and louder. Then, about 5 seconds before the Buick starts shooting off those flashes, the sound stops. A viewer of this tape can hear an exciting babble of voices, non-identifiable, all seeming to ask questions. Then the image disappears for the first time. The Buick and the shed are both gone, lost in the white.
Jesus Christ, did you guys see that?
Huddy Royer screams.
There are cries of, get back, holy fuck,
and everyone's favorite in times of trouble.
Oh, shit.
Someone says, don't look at it, and someone else says, it's pissing lightning, in that weirdly matter-of-fact tone one can sometimes hear on cockpit flight recorders.
a pilot who's talking without realizing it, who only knows that he's down to the last 10 or 12 seconds of his life. Then the Buick returns from the land of overexposure, looking first like a meaningless clot, then taking back its actual form. 3 seconds later, it flashes out again. The glare shoots thick rays from every window and then whites out the image once more. During this one, Kurt says, "We need a better filter." And Tony replies, "Maybe next time." The phenomenon continues for the next 46 minutes, every bit of it captured on tape. At first, the Buick whites out and disappears with every flash. Then, as the phenomenon starts to weaken, the viewer can see a vague car shape sunk deep in soundless light bursts that are more purple than white. Sometimes, the image joggles and there's a fast, blurry pan of human faces as Curtis hurries to a different observation point, hoping for a revelation, or perhaps just a better view. At 3:28:17, one can observe a jagged line of fire burst up from, or maybe it's through, the Buick's closed trunk. It shoots all the way to the ceiling, where it seems to splash outward like water from a fountain. Unidentified voice, "Holy shit, high voltage, high voltage!" Tony, "The hell it is." Then presumably to Kurt, "Keep taping." Kurt, "Oh yeah, you better believe it." There are several more of the lightning bolts, some shooting out of the Buick's window, some rising from the roof or the trunk. One leaps out from beneath the car and fires itself directly at the rear roll-up door. There are surprised yells as the men back away from that one, but the camera stays steady. Kurt was basically too excited to be afraid. At 3:55:03, there's a final weak blip. It comes from the back seat, behind the driver's position. And then there's no more. You can hear Tony Shanding say, "Why don't you save the battery, Kurt? The show seems to be over." At that point, the tape goes momentarily black. When the picture resumes at 4:08:16, Kurt is on screen. There's something yellow wrapped around his midsection. He waves jauntily and says, "I'll be right back." Tony Shandings, he's the one running the camera at that point, replies, "You better be." And he doesn't sound jaunty in the least. Kurt wanted to go in and check on the gerbils to see how they were, assuming they were still there at all. Tony refused permission adamantly and at once. No one was going in Shed B for quite a while, he said, not until they were sure it was safe to do so. He hesitated, maybe replaying that remark in his head and realizing the absurdity of it. As long as the Buick Roadmaster was in Shed B, it was never going to be safe. And changed it to, "Everyone stays out until the temperature's back over 65. "Someone's gotta go," Brian Cole said. He spoke patiently, as if discussing a simple addition problem with a person of limited intelligence. "I fail to see why, Trooper," Tony said. Brian reached into his pocket and pulled out Jimmy and Rosalind's water reservoir. "They got plenty of those pellets they eat, but without this, they'll die of thirst." "No, they won't. Not right away." "Well, it might be a couple of days before the temperature in there goes up to 65, Sarge. Would you want to go 48 hours without a drink?" "I know I wouldn't," Kurt said. Trying not to smile, and smiling a little anyway, he took the calibrated plastic tube from Brian. Then Tony took it from him before it could start to feel at home in Kurt's hand. The SC did not look at his fellow scholar as he did this. He kept his eyes fixed on Trooper Brian Cole. "I'm supposed to allow one of the men under my command to risk his life in order to bring water to a pair of pedigreed mice? Is that what you're telling me, Trooper? I just want to be clear on this." If he expected Brian to blush or scuffle, he was disappointed. Brian just kept looking at him in that patient way, as if to say, "Yes, yes, get it out of your system, boss.
The sooner you get it out of your system, the sooner you'll be able to relax and do the right thing.
I can't believe it, Tony said. One of us has lost his mind. Probably it's me.
They're just little guys, Brian said. His voice was as patient as his face. And we're the ones who put them in there, Sarge. They didn't exactly volunteer. We're responsible. Now, I'll do it if you want. I'm the one who forgot.
Tony raised his hands to the sky as if to ask for divine intervention, then dropped them back to his sides. Red was creeping out of his collar, up his neck, and over his jaw. It met the red patches on his cheeks.
Howdy do, neighbor. Hair pie, he muttered.
The men had heard him say this before and knew better than to crack a smile. It is at this point that many people, perhaps even a majority, would be apt to yell,
"Oh, screw it, do what you want," and stamp away.
But when you're in the big chair, getting the big bucks for making the big decisions, you can't do that. The D-troopers gathered in front of the shed knew this, and so, of course, did Tony. He stood there, looking down at his shoes. From out front of the barracks came the steady blad of Arkie's old red Briggs & Stratton mower.
"Sarge," Curtis began, "kid, do us all a favor and shut up."
Kurt shut up. After a moment, Tony raised his head. "The rope I asked you to pick up, did you get it?"
"Yes, sir. It's the good stuff. You could take it mountain climbing. At least that's what the guy at Calling All Sports said." "Is it in there?"
Tony nodded at the shed.
"No, in the trunk of my car."
"Well, thank God for small favors. Bring it over here, and I hope we never have to find out how good it is." He looked at Brian Cole.
"Maybe you'd like to go down to the Agway, or the Giant Eagle, Trooper Cole. Get those mice a few bottles of Evian or Poland spring water. Hell, Perrier, how about some Perrier?"
Brian said nothing, just gave the sergeant a little more of that patient look. Tony couldn't stand it and looked away.
"Mice with pedigrees, hair pie."
Kurt brought the rope, a length of triple braided yellow nylon at least 100 feet long. He made a sliding loop, cinched it around his waist, then gave the coil to Huddy Royer, who weighed 250 and always anchored when D-Troop played tug-of-war against the other PSP octets during the 4th of July picnic.
"If I give you the word," Tony told Huddy, "you yank him back like he just caught fire, and don't worry about breaking his collarbone or his thick skull pulling him through the door. Do you understand that?"
"Yes, Sarge."
"If you see him fall down or just start swaying on his feet like he's lightheaded, don't wait for the word. Just yank. Got it?"
"Yes, Sarge."
"Good. I'm very glad that someone understands what's going on here. Fucking hair pie summer camp snipe hunt is what it is."
He ran his hand through the short bristles of his hair, then turned to Kurt again.
"Do I need to tell you to turn around and come out of there if you sense anything, any slightest thing, wrong?"
"No."
"And if the trunk on that car comes open, Curtis, you fly. Got it? Fly out of there like a big-ass bird."
"I will.
Give me the video camera."
Curtis held it out and Tony took it.
Sandy wasn't there. Missed the whole thing.
But when Huddy later told him it was the only time he had ever seen the sergeant looking scared, Sandy was just as glad he spent that afternoon out on patrol. There were some things you just didn't want to see.
"You have 1 minute in the shed, Trooper Wilcox. After that, I drag you out whether you're fainting, farting, or singing Columbia, the Gem of the Ocean. 90 seconds.
"No.
And if you try one more time to bargain with me, your time goes down to 30 seconds.
Curtis Wilcox is standing in the sun outside the walk-in door on the north side of Shed B. The rope is tied around his waist. He looks young on the tape, younger with each passing year. He looked at that tape himself from time to time and probably felt the same, although he never said. And he doesn't look scared. Not a bit. Only excited. He waves to the camera and says, "I'll be right back."
You better be, Tony replies. Kurt turns and goes into the shed. For a moment, he looks ghostly, hardly there. Then Tony moves the camera forward to get it out of the bright sun, and you can see Kurt clearly again. He crosses directly to the car and starts around to the back.
No!
Tony shouts. No, you dummy, you want to foul the rope? Check the gerbils, give them their goddamn water, and get the hell out of there. Kurt raises one hand without turning, giving him a thumbs up. The picture jiggles as Tony uses the zoom to get in tighter on him. Curtis looks in the driver's side window, then stiffens and calls.
Holy shit!
Sarge, should I pull? Huddy begins, and then Kurt looks back over his shoulder. Tony's juggling the picture again. He doesn't have Kurt's light touch with the camera, and the image is going everywhere. But it's still easy enough to read the wide-eyed expression of shock on Curtis's face.
Don't you pull me back, Kurt shouts. Don't do it. I'm 5x5.
And with that, he opens the door of the Roadmaster.
Stay out of there, Tony calls from behind the madly jiggling camera.
Kurt ignores him and pulls the plastic gerbil condo out of the car, waggling it gently back and forth to get it past the big steering wheel. He uses his knee to shut the Buick's door and then comes back to the shed door with the Habitat cradled in his arms. With a square room at either end, the thing looks like some strange sort of plastic dumbbell.
Get it on tape!
Kurt is shouting, all but frying with excitement. Get it on tape! Tony did. The picture zooms in on the left end of the environment just as soon as Kurt steps out of the shed and back into the sun. And here is Rosalind, no longer eating, but scurrying about cheerfully enough. She becomes aware of the men gathered around her and turns directly toward the camera, sniffing at the yellow plastic, whiskers quivering, eyes bright and interested. It was cute, but the troopers from Statler D weren't interested in cute just then. The camera makes a herky-jerky pan away from her, traveling along the empty corridor to the empty gerbil gym at the far end. Both of the environment's hatches are latched tight, and nothing bigger than a gnat could get through the hole for the water tube. But Jimmy the gerbil is gone just the same. Just as gone as Ennis Rafferty, or the man with the Boris Badenoff accent, who had driven the Buick Roadmaster into their lives to begin with.